Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we're all grappling with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy, healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Hi, Brad.
It is so nice to see you back in the studio again. Happy New Year, too.
I know. This is like my Happy New Year show, so thank you. I'm happy to be back here. That's like my old school introduction. I felt like I had stepped back in time.
Well, I'll be honest with you. The new one, I struggled to find it. It's been a while since I used it.
So
I couldn't do the old, just nothing. So
I appreciate that. It feels like kind of a reset in ways. But yes, it's nice to be back. I took some time off in December to kind of resettle and ready to come back in January. Had shows all set to go, and I woke up, and it was also the first week back at school at Cal Poly. And you know that feeling? I'd gone to class the first day, that Monday the 5th, and I teach about 7 hours. So I lecture about 7 hours, which is a lot anyway on a voice.
That's a lot.
It usually gets a little tired. But by the time I got to the end of my day, I could feel it's like I'm having a hard time even making sound come out. This is weird. And I got up the next day, Tuesday morning, and it wasn't gravelly because I've, again, used to a gravelly voice, used to kind of feeling like a husky voice. I knew I was sick and had something going on, but there was zero sound. I couldn't make any sound. And I thought, that's really strange. And I guess this is what real laryngitis feels like. And assumed that, you know, the next day it would start to come back or come around. I was kind of going through whatever this plague is that everyone seems to be passing around to each other. But the no sound lasted for 8 days.
Wow.
I know. So the next day of classes, that Wednesday, I had to cancel classes because I could make no sound. And that's an auspicious way to start the quarter. And then I kept saying, well, that's going to rest my voice, good silent meditations, and kind of silent retreats. And then I went through the weekend expecting, of course, if I'm quiet, it's going to come back for Monday classes. Still not there. And so I wrote out all of my lecture notes and had one of my students read through my lecture notes and show my PowerPoints while I sat there kind of nodding and making hand gestures and writing things on the chalkboard. And then Tuesday again, nothing. So I missed you again that week. And then after like Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, I got up and I think I found my voice. And so it's been slowly getting better. Today is the best it has sounded. But there's so much going on in my psyche about this whole experience. You know, from the pragmatic part, we can just say, you got a virus. It became viral laryngitis, like my doctor said, and it went away and it came back and you're in the process of healing. So I get that. Just the pragmatic, that's the answer.
Those are the facts.
That's the facts. But the wooey part of me mm-hmm. is saying there's so much happening with this idea of losing the voice. The second piece for me, before I get to the real wooey, is the panic that I started to feel about day three or four, because I started getting into my head about, oh, my livelihood is my voice. Mm-hmm. Like that thing that I most bank on is my ability to speak. I don't have a job that I can do on the computer, or I can't fake it. I have to be able to speak. And then so that started getting into my head. Like, what if it never came back? Like, what if I wasn't able to? Maybe everything I ever was going to say in my life now exists in a podcast.
Whoa.
Somewhere. I really got into my head and tried not to tell anyone so they wouldn't know what a freaker I am.
Come on now.
But it was really like the whole thought of, did I say everything that I meant to say in my lifetime in case I never get to say anything again? So I grappled with that for a while. That's part two. So there's the facts, and then there's the part two of the getting in my head and being worried about this long term. And then part three was the wooey part. So of course I have to deep dive into, what does it mean to lose your voice symbolically, metaphorically? And I'm going to read you some of them and you can see where you might relate to them as well. Symbolically, losing your voice represents a profound loss of personal power, autonomy, and self-expression, often signifying that you feel unheard, silenced, or unable to communicate your truth. Now, the facts part of me is like, well, that's not true because I have a microphone in a classroom. All I do is share what I know and experience self-expression on a regular basis. But the last piece of that, which said, unable to communicate your truth, we're going to touch on that today because that has stuck with me throughout this whole process.
Yeah, I can see why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The next piece is that it acts as a metaphor for fear of speaking up, suppressed emotions, or deep internal conflict. Now, we won't go into the deep internal conflict unless, you know, there's any of my former wooey friends who are listening and want to send me notes off the air. There could be a whole land of things happening that I'm missing. But I'm staying in the surface part of this where it says fear of speaking up and suppressed emotions. Okay, the fear of speaking up goes back to, again, communicating your truth. The next little info piece about losing your voice is a feeling that your ideas, creativity, or opinions are being stifled either by yourself or by external pressure.
Oh, man.
So again, we have to revisit this again. Again, it's all part of today. There was so much. That was the other thing that was concerning. There was way too much about this significance or symbolism of losing your voice. The next piece was powerlessness and vulnerability, lacking control over your environment, or being unable to defend yourself. Okay. That also plays into a bit of the overall theme for today. We'll come back to it. The next piece was unexpressed emotions, words left unsaid that are stuck in your throat, often linked to a fear of disapproval or conflict. The next piece, I know, it goes on and on. I only have two more, though. We won't do the whole show. The next is internal conflict or grief. Going back to if my wooey friends are listening, the idea that there is a choked voice, the idea that a choked voice can symbolize profound sorrow, mourning, or emotional overwhelm. Now, I'll go with the emotional overwhelm for a bit too, because I had a hell of a fall, as you know. And so I could see where that stress would play out. And then finally, the one my husband would say is probably the symbolic reason why I went into 8 days of not speaking was that symbolically, it is a time for quiet reflection as a need to listen more than you speak.
Yeah.
Or take a break from constant communication.
Yeah.
So if we were taking a poll in my family as to what the symbolic meaning was, I think most of them would say, oh, ding, ding, last one, a need for quiet reflection, a time to listen more than you speak, or taking a break from constant communication.
I don't know about you, but that's one that I actually try to actively work on is to listen more, talk less, but it gets kind of difficult, as anybody who knows me will tell you.
This show would be much different if I came in every week and just listened, because I think there would be a lot of dead air. So there is that piece. But yes, I appreciate the listening part because there's a lot going on in the world and a lot of words and feelings and emotions that are needing to be expressed. And that kind of takes me to the second part of today's show, which is what's happening in Minnesota and all over the country and how it is we can or cannot show up for it or feel that we can or cannot show up for it. And here's where I feel that, what was the thing I circled? Challenge to communicate my truth or being stifled by myself or external pressure, which is not that much, but this feeling that it's tenuous to speak all the things that you believe to be true because you don't know what kind of reactions you're going to receive, whether it's within your family. And we talk about that all the time, especially with our political divides and how many people's families are split because they don't share the same worldview or belief system right now, and just all of the trauma that that's causing people experiencing these splits with their family, because our family is that place where we're supposed to be able to retreat to when the world gets crazy. But we've been experiencing that our families are not that safe place to retreat to because speaking our minds out to each other causes great disruption or can cause great disruption. And now kind of out into the greater community in the world with things coming unglued or feeling chaotic, and it's not new. Things have felt growing chaos for a long time, but it just really feels like it's erupting. And now we don't have that escape back to that family pod where you're supposed to be able to take a deep breath and relax. And so in many ways, I feel like all of us are experiencing some sort of cultural laryngitis. Maybe not everyone. I see people out there feeling free to speak their truth, and they're standing up and they're holding their signs and they're walking. And I have to tell you, in all honesty, I admire them, but I don't believe I can do that because of the positions that I hold in my community. I can't sit behind this microphone, I don't believe, in all good measure, I don't know what the word I want to use, and just lay one my version of the world on everyone. Because I am supposed to hold a space for conversation between people in our community about their thoughts and feelings. And so that gives me a sense of responsibility that I need to be more receptive, listen more than I speak, and be able to navigate when feelings conflict or thoughts or opinions conflict with what I might be feeling. Because at the end of the day, in this space, what I think and feel is kind of the foundation of the show. But when the phone lines are open, it's what the community thinks or feels, or the callers who've had the gusto to call in, because it's scary to call in to a radio show. And if someone has the courage to call in and speak their truth, then it's my job to let them have that space.
And so, I got to tell you, thank you for saying that, because that resonates very well with me and my feelings about our responsibility and mine as a broadcaster too. And I think you helped me down from a little minor cliff that I was looking over the edge of when it comes to the creative space.
There is that piece. And then there are other, you know, places in my life, in the classroom, where I also have a responsibility to hold that space for my students. I'm there to teach them, to share what I know. But unlike math or chemistry, you know, social sciences has a lot of gray area. And so I choose every day what it is I'm going to talk about. I mean, I have my curriculum, I have my topics, I have the things that I'm covering in family psychology that my students are going to talk about, you know, communication, relationships, marriage, parenting, old age, midlife. We cover the whole developmental life cycle. And I have that in front of me. But how I present all of that information in my class is my choice. Because if you look at the textbooks that I look through and am sent all the time that are can be used for family psychology classes, each of these textbooks have different lenses through which they look at family or look at the subject matter. And so I, as a professor, get to choose what articles I share with my students and what, you know, material that I introduce to them in class. And there's a great responsibility in that. And every professor, again, unless it's math or chemistry, but maybe math and chemistry as well, has a bias of some sort that we bring into the classroom because it's part of our learned experience and the lens through which we see the world. And we teach what we know. But right now, and I feel this all the time, but right now especially, knowing the population of my students, which in my class, I have 52 in just one class. And in that class, I would say pretty confidently that at least a third to a half of my students have a very conservative background and experience and lens to which they see the world. And I grapple with my responsibility to respect that and not force a perspective into them, but to give them the opportunity to read material and learn different theories and experience research and then come to their own conclusions. But it's hard because the grandma in me so wants to get up there sometimes and just tell him how it is.
Right.
But then I remind myself, I'm telling him how it is for me. And so I have to back off and make space for them to figure out what it is for them as well.
Right.
Knowing full well that in the role of professor, that many professors just tell them how it is from their perspective because they've earned that right to speak out in academia, which is a whole other class topic as well, because we've seen the shutting down of free thinking or free speaking in academia in many places around the country. But that's not our topic today. I'm thinking more of a personal responsibility. So I'm not really sure what I'm opening the phone lines for today. I'm opening them because I want to hear your thoughts and feelings, because I do recognize that the repression of feelings is really harmful. And the feelings might be different than the thoughts and beliefs and opinions, but the feelings that are underneath the thoughts and beliefs and opinions. I can tell you that my feelings right now are so jumbled that the laryngitis in my throat has moved down to the pit in my stomach and that I just am a total knot of feelings that I feel that I'm expressing but not really being able to express, because I don't even know where to put them, because I'm not even sure what the outcome might be. Because you might realize that when people come in for therapy or they're grappling with something, they'll come in knotted up with feelings. And the idea of therapy is to help someone find the safety to let those feelings out. And yet, rarely can we let those feelings out until we feel pretty sure there is another place we can get to. That the idea that we're going to express these feelings and nothing changes, or we're just now we're in a whole hole of these dark feelings, makes the work of therapy really challenging, almost impossible. That in order for people to feel like they can say what it is that's dark inside of them, they need to have a sense and a belief that they're going to another place, that they'll express this and it will open up new options for their lives or new ways of being. So that might feel a little not clear, and that's okay, because great conversations generally aren't clear, because if they were clear, that means it's just one person's idea of the conversation. So the phone lines are opening up. How are you feeling? What comes up for you? Where's your voice? How are you able to express, or do you feel like you're held back at all? I am interested to know where you are with all this, just having been through this last almost month experience. You're listening to A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And as always, well, not always, but most of the time, you're invited to be part of the conversation. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of the conversation after the show by giving us a call or sending me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also send me a message to my Instagram or Facebook, and I'm happy to respond to you there as well. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast our show wherever it is you get your podcasts, or even on Spotify. Just search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you can subscribe and leave a review. That would be great, so more people can join the conversation as well. So we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to rest my voice a little, and we'll come back, open the phone lines, and continue the conversation right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Seems I've got to have a change of scene, 'cause every night I have the strangest dream. Prison by the way it could be. Left here on my own, or so it seems. I've got to leave before I start to scream. Someone's locked the door and took the key. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, you're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself. Well, boy, you sure took me for one big ride. And even now I sit and wonder why. That when I think of you I start to cry. Just can't waste my time, I must keep trying. Gotta stop believing in all your lies, 'cause there's too much to do before I die. You're feeling alright. I'm not feeling too good myself.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Welcome in. Today, we're opening the phone lines to see how your voice is feeling. Are you able to speak out freely? What is it that you need to say or want to say? And do we have a responsibility to filter or monitor what it is we want to say without fear? Because I think a lot of people are feeling that their voice is being tamped down, or that they themselves are feeling like they need to tamp it down as well. Our number is 805-781-3875 to be part of the conversation. And Chris, thanks for calling in. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, I think that most people just don't feel free to say what they want, whether it's their work environment, they're afraid of backlash there, or family. It kind of reminds me of, you know, you heard the old story, I guess maybe in country songs, about brother fighting brother, North versus South, back in the Civil War. And maybe it was just a good story to tell in writing a country song. I don't know if it really happened, but, you know, things get really contested. Do people really, you know, do they really express their emotions, or do they just kind of stuff them? I think most of the time they stuff their emotions and it takes a toll, but they let it slide.
So where do the emotions go, the feelings go? And thank you for being a man and calling in, because just by gender, you probably spent most of your life mastering the art of stuffing your feelings. Maybe I'm wrong, but that seems to be kind of the role of men in our society. Where do your emotions go?
Well, I don't know. I guess it's tough because, you know, from a young age, we're told to be a responsible citizen. You have to speak up if something doesn't seem right, and you know, when someone does, you know your leaders applaud them for it. But in reality, sometimes it's just too difficult. And yeah, where do the emotions go? I don't know. I guess they take a toll. Maybe, you know, some people turn to alcohol or you know, act out in other ways, in a negative way. Or it just becomes an unhealthy lifestyle, unhealthy stress.
Because it's interesting you brought up the workplace, too. That's another, like the family tinderbox. I would imagine the workplace, given our political divide, is really tenuous for people. Not a safe place maybe never a place that we're encouraged to speak your mind. You know, you couldn't hang posters or sayings or things that might be offensive to other people. But I wonder if it's more intense now.
I think so. You know, I've worked in a environment with some, you know, multiple viewpoints, but the few who have in my environment, my work environment, the few who had the temerity to express the more liberal viewpoint maybe they weren't ostracized, but people just make fun of them, and they kind of lost respect in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a tough topic, and it's a tough time because we're encouraged to listen more than we speak. But also, if we don't speak, are we not doing our due diligence as citizens, as you mentioned at the beginning of the call? What do you feel is your due diligence as a citizen? What do you feel that your responsibility is?
Well, I think we should be more tolerant of other people, of everybody saying what they want to say. We should feel free to be able to speak out and say, that looks wrong, that doesn't feel right. Mm-hmm. But people don't. But I think we should. That's our responsibility. If it doesn't seem right, we should say it. You know this, and I think the people that have made progress in changing our society have been the people that are kind of a pain in the side, the ones that are kind of annoyingly outspoken. Good for them.
That is a good point too. Yes, because nothing changes in a vacuum. Change happens when 20% of the population changes their mind about something. And I think there was a BBC story that talked about 3.5% of the population taking action on this. And that's what changes things in society. And I wonder if everyone in society is ever really on board with the change that happens.
Yeah. You know, having grown up in the 60s and 70s, I just assumed up until a few years ago that, you know, everyone was on board with diversity. What's wrong with hearing everybody's viewpoint? What's wrong with equality? Right. And now, you know, this, I was surprised to hear of a backlash against diversity and equity and inclusion. And worse, but, you know, the things that are happening now, it's like, wow, people really are white supremacists? I thought that was truly a thing of the past.
Yeah. I think the explosion of this division in how people saw the world has caught a lot of people off guard as well. Anything else, Chris? Yeah.
No, thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to call. I appreciate it. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. What's stuck in your craw? What does your voice want to express or need to share? Because there's a lot of, you know, it's an interesting idea that we tell our children, most parents, you know, find your voice, speak your mind, share your truth, tell people how you feel, you know, don't be a, what's the word? Not a shriveling flower, a wallflower, but
shrinking violet.
Thank you. I could not find that anywhere in my head. That's why I have you there. Yes, don't be a shrinking violet, right? Speak out. But then we see people paying the price for speaking out, or, you know, being too loud or too noisy, or, you know, causing chaos. It's so easy how things can get spun and turned around and the emotions that go behind it. And so the therapist in me is thinking, what is the safe outlet for emotions? Because we don't want people stuffing their feelings. That's how, you know, as my previous caller talked about, the alcoholism, people get addicted to video games, a lot of violence. There is some thought that men partake in excessive watching of sports like boxing and football and hockey because it gives them this way to express their emotions, to feel that the release of these emotions. But it becomes addictive, this excessive watching of sports, because it's the only way they can feel safe in letting those things out. And so what is the off-gassing of all these emotions so that we can, in polite company or in community or in a classroom, feel comfortable enough having discourse and not be triggered in this really deep way? You know, that sense that we have where the blood starts flushing up into our face and you can almost feel it immediately. There's certain things that, you know, can be said in my family or in other situations. Even in my friend group, you know, when we had a party a few weeks ago, which is probably why I got sick, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But we had a gathering, a yearly gathering, you know, I love all of my friends. We've been friends for over 20 something years, but a couple things, you know, get said now and then, and it's always kind of the same thing, and I can feel it hit me the wrong way. And instead I'm like, oh, why do they have to say that? And it really starts to bother me, and my stomach kind of knots up. But in my head, I go, it's not something to call out, right? I'm not going to make an issue of it here because we're in a polite situation and community with our friends. And so I clearly am grappling with all of these nuances of what it is to be a human in community. I want to have relationships. I want to have my friends. So if I'm bashing on them all the time for the things they say that I might find annoying, that's going to be a lonely experience of social. And as a citizen, and I see things happening that feel so wrong on a deeply profound level for me. Like, that's not right. You shouldn't feel that way. But then the therapist and professor in me in the middle goes, they get to feel that way. Because I'm speaking from my life's worldview and perspective. Even though it feels so right to me that what I feel is correct, I can't lord that over people. It's not right. Another way to say it. Not just not right, but it's it goes along with one other piece. I'm also the oldest child in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And oldest children in their family believe that they are right.
Don't talking to an oldest child here.
You get it, right? So oldest children cannot imagine that there is a world where there are other ways of looking at things. It makes us very powerful. It's also why most presidents, astronauts, leaders of industry, they happen to be entrepreneurs, happen to be oldest children. And it's those middle children that are really good at seeing both ends of the story because they've had to navigate younger siblings, older siblings, and kind of mediate the two. So they tend to be really good at hearing both sides of the story. They're great mediators. And then youngest children, babies of the family, can also have a really hard time believing that everything that they believe is also not true. Like babies of the family feel very empowered that their thoughts are also correct.
But now, I'm wondering now, the situation that you've explained is kind of in a oldest, middle, and youngest. Do you have any data on just when it's, two siblings, older and younger?
Yes, the older one believes that they are totally correct, and the younger one learns to be subservient to that experience, or they flop roles when there's two. There's usually a dominant child and a non. But so there's so many pieces that go into how it is we present in the world. And again, that family order is just another. So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. And I started the show talking about how I lost my voice for 8 days, could not speak. And clearly I'm excited to have it back because I have a lot to say. But I also want to hear from you. How free do you feel to speak? Are there things you hold down? Do you feel like we have a responsibility to speak our mind at all times in order to make sure that our perspectives are heard? Because quite often, in a culture that has a powerful force leading the narrative, it's scary to speak out against that narrative. And yet, is it our responsibility to speak out against the narrative to make sure that more stories are told? 805-781-3875. We're going to take a quick break and rest my voice some more and come back and continue the conversation and take your calls right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. And people in the street singing songs and a carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist.
Elizabeth, I have to tell you something. I am currently reading the biography of a really good biography my son gave me of Neil Young.
Oh.
Covers this song very much.
Beautifully.
And as we know, it was written in the wake of riots in L.A. And then later on, of course, Ohio came after with the shooting in Ohio. And it just shows that no matter how far we've come, we haven't come that far.
Well, and there is rhyme and reason for the songs that I picked for the show because I want them to align with the things we're kind of talking about today. Thanks for tuning in. Our number is 805-781-3875. Brett, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Well, my take on the current situation is that we have made space for, because of our tolerance, we have made space for the intolerant to take the center stage and curb our tolerance.
And how do you respond to that yourself?
I respond to that by speaking out every time I get a chance. It's not about offending people. It's about now we're to the point of right and wrong. And it's dead wrong to shoot people in the street. Mm-hmm. It's dead wrong to pick people up that don't need to be picked up. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be called out at every point.
And do you feel that by speaking out, does it help you like release the feelings that you're having about it? Do you feel like it's educating people? Like how does this, I'm going to say therapist
I don't
thing.
Know that it educates people. I would hope that maybe I would chip away at the people on the fringes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the most important thing is if I speak out, maybe somebody else will have the courage to speak out.
Yes, because there is that leadership piece of someone needs to say it first, and then you hope that everyone stands up behind you and supports.
And as we look at history, it wasn't easy for Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or Malcolm X or any of the folks that we look up to speak out and do and say the things that they did.
As my first caller said, though, did it surprise you how, as soon as kind of the veil came down, how many people rushed in to show their racism and their, you know, white supremacist values or their different values that seem to have not been part of the culture for so long? Did that surprise you?
No, not really. I know that there are a lot of people who feel like they have been given the short end of the stick while they live in the most affluent culture that has ever existed in the world.
Yeah. And is that their personal, you know, lack of information, or do you think that that's a purposeful narrative that's sent out by our culture to kind of keep people at odds with each other?
I think that a certain faction of our culture has promoted that narrative.
Yeah. What else is on your mind, Brett?
That's pretty much it. I would encourage you and everybody else to speak out every time you get a chance.
Thank you. I appreciate you calling in and speaking out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So Brett brings up another piece of my thought process today. And it's, again, comes from my classroom because, you know, I'm in a situation where these things are happening every day, what's happening in Minnesota, and my students come in and it feels very disingenuous to just start in with my lecture and not acknowledge the experiences that everyone's having, because these kids are really locked in, you know, fortunately, through social media, they're just getting constant news and information all the time. And so I feel like I need to address what they're seeing and hearing. But again, trying hard not to impose myself on them, because I set myself up to lose their trust and faith if I'm too harsh. And again, it's a really tough place to be, that holding on to my feelings and making sure I leave space. But I want to lead it to what's happening right now with an assignment, which is that my students are asked to read Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. If you have not read that, please do. It should be required reading for my show. And then the second one is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, another great read for the show. But I have them read both the books through the lens of mental health and what their narrative is about how we got to where we are in our mental health and how to address mental health. Man's Search for Meaning, very, very briefly, is a look at existential psychotherapy and the whole idea that existentially what rules all of us is this fear of death and realization at some point in all of our lives that life is really meaningless and that we're just floating around, and how people address that sense of meaninglessness, that existential crisis, how they address that really informs or determines how they live their lives. How do they, you know, some people with that existential crisis or that sense of emptiness get into drugs or drinking or, you know, gambling, or they try to over-consuming, they try to fill it with those things, that a sense of emptiness. And then the other piece that Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning would talk about is finding what it is that matters most. If it's love, if it's having, you know, work that is important to you, being of service to others, having a way that you are involved in community. So that's one of the books. Then the other one, Ishmael, talks about this idea of mother culture and how mother culture hums in our head all the time, reminding us every day in and day out, what our values should be and what is true for mother culture and therefore how it is we're supposed to live. Ishmael, Daniel Quinn, defines mother culture as the omnipresent, unquestioned set of beliefs, myths, and stories that are passed down through generations that dictate how a society behaves and perceives the world. Mother culture, this narrative, it's hidden, but very persuasive, and it shapes our lifestyles. It's the voice in our ear, the voice of everyone in everyone's ear since birth that delivers through the media, through education, and through the social norms that we all follow, making its tenets feel like it's just common sense. It's just the truth, rather than being a specific cultural choice. People are generally unaware that they're actually living a myth or a story or something that's just been humming in the background and taught to them through education and through the media and through their social norms. We like to think and believe that we're making our own unique conscious decisions or unique informed decisions, but all of us, according to Mother Culture and Ishmael, are really captive of this narrative that we're all kind of living out. So in the discussion in class, I asked the students, how do you see mother culture playing out just in Minnesota itself? That you clearly have factions of people who are living the truth as they have been told is the truth from the time they are young, through the media, through their own education, through the social norms. And that means the groups that they belong to, the people that they associate with, the church that they go to, right? The recreation that they participate in, the sports that they do. Like all of those pieces of mother culture inform us to what is true. And when we live it and are immersed in it all the time, then you can see why it feels like our beliefs are just common sense. Like, of course, all of this is right, what I think and believe. And it is the truth. And I have the students discuss this because it feels unconscionable for everyone when they see something that is wrong and can't imagine how anyone else can see the same thing and tell a different story. And it's why this powerful video images that people are seeing are so confounding, that we can be watching, again, right, the same videos and having a different narrative afterward. And it's because this mother culture, this common sense or the truth that we've been taught to believe since the time we were born, when it is challenged, it causes such great dissonance and fear and anxiety in people that they lash out to protect that belief system, because the alternative, having that belief system blown up, is unthinkable, because what happens is we fall into the existential crisis. Oh my goodness, everything I believed is wrong, and therefore I am meaningless, my life is meaningless, and how do I live with that? And that's how these books in my class, I hope, come together for my students and where the discussion goes.
Do you think that the mother culture changes with each generation in some way?
It alters in ways.
The reason I ask is because you and I grew up in roughly the same era. And
I'm much younger than you, Brad.
I'm kidding. but you are younger than I am. But I don't know about you, but in my growing up during the 60s, we were really started to be taught the concepts of equality and, you know, this land is your land, this land is my land, and those things. And that informs my belief system to this day, plus the reinforcement that I got at home, which was don't judge people by the color of their skin, but judge them by the content of their character. But it seems to me that in subsequent generations, kids that grew up in the 70s and the 80s and 90s and so forth, that message has been supplemented in service of a different set of priorities.
So there's two pieces to that. One is the idea of the social construction theory. Now I'm going to get into professor mode. But the social construction theory talks about a dominant truth, the dominant T. And that is the dominant story that people that run a culture. And those who are in power determine what the dominant T is. And in our culture, we're really dominated. We're really led by corporate culture and, you know, the determining of what we should believe in and what should be important to us. And it's fed through social media and the media. And it leaks into our education system as well, and controls a lot of the governance that happens. The dominant T, truth, can shift when people are voted out of power. So whatever group is in power, they can influence legislation, politics in some ways. But what you mentioned, this idea of here's how I was raised and here's what I was taught to believe, and that seemed to be so different, I would argue is no, it wasn't different, because at the same time you were being taught these things in school and through the media and what you saw on television and your parents, there was still whole factions of society that were still learning different lessons from their mother culture through their religion, through their neighborhoods, through what they were experiencing. As Brett mentioned, you know, when you have this sense and this story that you are losing out because certain people are coming in and taking your jobs and your opportunity, those stories never changed. They just weren't the dominant story, the dominant truth at that time, which highlights what I'm trying to say is that it's difficult to walk into a classroom with this really strong set of, this makes sense, it's common sense, it has to be the truth, I saw it on video, and try to impose that in some ways on my students when they are having just as important experiences themselves in their community, in their homes, through their social media, that they're seeing a different common sense and different truth. Doesn't mean that people can't change, but as I said before, and this is a key point, is that when we, mother culture is so deep and so strong, you don't see it as a story. No one would believe that they're following a myth. They would say, no, I'm not following a myth. I'm following with the truth. That's the truth that I believe. It's not a myth. Don't call my belief system a myth. You can imagine how people get fired up because it's so insidious and so invisible that the cultural narrative just is the truth. And if you question the truth, and we're seeing it so clearly with the videos, and that people are having to face what they're seeing in front of their own eyes as not being true, but instead of being able to change their perception and their minds, they have to attack the narrative to protect their sense of what is right and what is true. Because if they question it or lose that sense of what is true, they are caught in that existential crisis. What is the meaning of my life if everything I believed was not true? And therein lies the essence of existential psychology and existential therapy and man's search for meaning. Viktor Frankl talked about logotherapy. And I think the only way we come to, I don't really know if it's a fix, but the way we try to come to more of a consensus or middle ground, or to heal this major divide, is how do we create a more universal sense of meaning in people's lives, of being of service to others, of leaning in with love, of having meaningful work that feels like it matters. Like when those things can exist for someone, then maybe it's easier to let go of the other parts of the story that don't serve them or us, that we have to nurture, gently alter that mother culture noise, but it has to be replaced with something that feels real, like meaningful work or service to others, or feeling like we're valued and that we are safe, and feeling safe is the other piece of it. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I just want to kind of circle back around to this idea of how it is we can address those feelings that we have and speak out and feel like our voice can be heard, but also still feel safe and seen in our society. And it's interesting that, like, the caller Brett was talking about feeling that he needed to speak out, and that was important, and wishing that everyone else spoke out. On the other side of that, there is that gender piece, that as women in society, we are taught from a very young age to not speak out or take up too much space or to be too loud or to be too bossy or to be too noisy, because that puts us as women in really dangerous situations, that our culture, our mother culture, our narrative around men and women is still very much patriarchal, is still very much that men have the power, physical and social and cultural. And so that ability to really stand up and have yourself be heard is always measured by, is there a level of safety for me in our society? So I think if there's any takeaway from today, I hope it's around this idea that we all are living a cultural narrative that we have been taught from the time we were born. And how do we have, I don't know if grace is the right word, but how do we make space when people seem to be completely on the other side of an issue from us, that are looking at the same videos or the same experience and having a completely different experience of this? How do we have that? How do we find that place in ourselves to say, we have grown up in the same place, but with completely different stories or mythologies driving our belief system? And when that belief system is challenged, it feels terrifying. Even if we act out with rage and anger or attacking the other person, what's inside, deeply inside everyone, is this fear that they might be wrong. And what would happen if they had to deal with the consequences of being completely wrong? And how would they move forward from that? This has been a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. I'm happy to receive your emails to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or on Instagram or Facebook. Leave me a message there. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org or podcast or show. Go to Spotify or wherever else you get your podcasts. Look for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe and please leave a review so others can find us as well. As always, thank you for tuning in, being a part of our community, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I do believe.